Welcome everyone to the Open Rights Group Sheffield. Today we've got Cory Doctorow speaking, but information doesn't want to be free.
Yeah.
Off you go.
All right. That was an admirably brief introduction. Thank you. Am I using the mic, or is it just decorative? I mean, it's a small enough room. I probably don't need it, but... Or is it not on? Have you tried turning it off and on again?
It's probably a small enough.
Is there anyone having any hard time hearing me if I speak at about this volume? All right. You can hear us. You can hear me at the back? All right. I think I'll dispense with the mic. I've got the recording devices anyway. So thank you all for coming, and thank you, Org, for hosting me here. It's a pleasure to come up. I am not from your shores, as you can hear, although I'm a naturalized Briton. I put my hand over my heart at Hackney Town Hall and sang God Save the Queen, as they make you do now. And the Speaker of Hackney Town Hall told me that now that I lived in a democracy, I had to be involved in civic engagement. And I thanked her for rescuing me from my long Canadian totalitarian nightmare. And here I stand before you. And like many of you, I earn some of my living from stuff I do on the internet, creative labor I do on the internet. And those of you who aren't doing that now, chances are you're going to be earning some fraction of your income from the internet in the future, because everything we do today involves the internet, and everything we do tomorrow is going to require the internet. And so the internet is going to be a part of our lives for better or for worse, kind of from now on, and an increasing one as well. And the wonderful thing about earning a living from creative labor is that there's so many ways to do it. In fact, virtually every commercially successful artist you can think of is a one-off. What he or she does is really distinct to that person's art and how they conduct it and the people who want to support them. And that's quite nice. It means that there's lots of different ways you can fit things together. But the corollary is that there's a terrible thing about creative labor, which is that it's insanely hard to figure out exactly how you piece a living together from it. In fact, this is a pre-internet phenomenon. Almost everyone who's ever set out to make any kind of money from the arts has not only failed to make money from the arts, but has lost money in the process of trying to make money from the arts. And this is true independent of what medium we're talking about, or which era we're talking about, or the technology around us, or what policies prevailed. I mean, really, the only thing that you can imagine that would ensure that everyone who wanted to be an artist had a middle-class income was a policy that said everyone who calls themselves an artist gets £40,000 a year until they stop. Short of that, there's probably going to be a lot of artistic disappointment. Indeed, a livelihood from the creative fields is so rare that it's possible that it's just a statistical anomaly, like a Six Sigma event. Like, if you lined up millions of people and had them all flip coins all day long, eventually some of them would have the coins land edge on, and maybe the people who get the coin to land edge on are particularly good at flipping, or maybe it's just the fact that if you flip enough coins, some of them will land on the edge. But it's obvious that the thing that unites edge-on winners, by and large, is not a particular skill at coin flippery. It's just luck. And speaking as someone who got lucky in the arts, I think mostly it's just luck that makes artists successful. But if the winners of the edge-on coin toss were feted and handsomely paid and featured on the covers of magazines, it's likely that a lot of people would try their hands at becoming professional coin tossers, which is where you get to laugh at the Canadian who said tossers. after all, you know, that's why people buy lottery tickets. And what's more, if flipping a coin, and this is where coin flipping and art are different, but if flipping a coin was deeply and profoundly satisfying and made a heartfelt connection between the coin tosser and the people watching the coin tossing competition, then a living in the coin tossing world, we think of it as like a downright noble accomplishment. And I think that's basically the arts, because making art seems to be innate to the human condition. Those of you who have kids or who look after kids, you've seen them do this. You know, as soon as they can, they start expressing themselves through arts. Babies express themselves through art. We treat people with horrible PTSD with art therapy, singing and telling stories and making pictures. These things, they seem to come built into the human condition. And we treat successful artists with a reverence that kind of borders on worship, which certainly makes for an attractive proposition for pursuing a career in the arts, at least if you're on the outside looking in. There are a lot of very unhappy artists, although I'm pretty happy doing what I do. But the arts are fundamentally a non-market activity. People who set out to make art for a living are not engaged in rational economic calculus. They're setting out to win the edge-on coin contest, where beyond trying a lot and practicing a lot, there's not really any good ways to improve your odds without getting very, very lucky. So when we talk about the internet and the arts, we tend to focus on which business models serve artists best, but that's backwards. That's what economists call survivor bias, examining the people who are successful and trying to backform a policy from that. There are so many people pursuing the arts at any given moment that whatever technologically possible living exists in any given technological moment, there'll be plenty of artists who can make that kind of art waiting to fill the pipeline. Back when the only way to make a living singing was to perform live, everybody who was making a living singing was performing live. When the phonogram and the radio came along, those people said, what do you mean you want me to be a mere clerk and sit indoors and let other people go and talk to my audience for me. I'm not a mere clerk. I'm a performer. I do something old and holy, like the first story told in front of the first fire. But there was no shortage of people for whom recording and sitting in a back room was natural. And those people, 70 years later, when artists started to tour to make their living, said, what do you mean you want me to be a trained monkey? I'm not a performer. I'm a white-collar worker. I labor indoors with my muse. And when I'm done, I slide the product of my creativity under the door and leave it to some bourgeois man of commerce to take it out into the marketplace. You've no right to tell me how to earn a living. But, you know, the thing about this innate artisticness that seems to be built into our condition is that whatever it is technology favors, there's lots of art. And so when we argue about the arts and copyright and technology, the one argument that I think we should just have no credo for or no time for is the idea that unless we do such and such or so and so, there just won't be any of the kind of art that you love. I mean, there may be other good social justice reasons to make sure that the people you love are getting paid, but the idea that the art supply will dry up just doesn't seem to stand up to any kind of rational inquiry. Now, the other problem with this is that when you preserve the business models that made the successes out of last year's lotto winners, you often do so at the expense of next year's potential lotto winners. You're guaranteeing that things will stay fixed and in the situation that is best for the people who lucked into being the right people in the right place, but at the expense of all the people who are waiting to be the right people in the right place. It's a nice deal for last year's lottery winners. And speaking as one of those lottery winners, I'm not entirely adverse to that proposal. But it's the kind of a cure that's likely to be worse than the disease, because business models reflect wider social technological questions. Our technology, our economy, our politics, and our tastes. And when you freeze in the old business models, you do so at the expense of everyone who would succeed in the new ones, and you end up going to war against those technological, economic, political, and social factors that are selecting for the new business models. Now, speaking as an artist who found a niche in the business models of the past two decades, and is hoping to find a niche in the next decades to come, I'm here to suggest that our priority shouldn't be defending business models. It should be to ensure that whatever business models are succeeding at any given moment, that those business models keep as much money as possible and as much control as possible in the hands of the people who create things, and secondarily in the people who invest in their creativity, and last in the distributors and the retailers who distribute it. And to that end, I'm going to propose tonight three ironclad laws for keeping money flowing in the right way. Things that we can choose as creators, that politicians and regulators can backstop, that audiences and businesses can act upon to put money in the pockets of the people most directly involved in creating the art that we love. Now, the first law, I call these Dr. O's three laws, and the first law here is law number one. Anytime someone puts a lock on something that belongs to you and won't give you the key to unlock it, that lock is not there for your benefit. And I came up with this law. I gave a talk at a publishing conference in New York about 5 years ago, and I had lunch with my agent that day, and my agent is Arthur C. Clarke's agent, now Arthur C. Clarke's estate's agent. And I said, I came up with a law. And he said, no, you have to have three laws, which is why I have three laws. So if you ever make something that you want to sell on the internet and you upload it to a marketplace like Amazon or Steam or Apple's stores, you'll get this little tick box that says, would you like to protect this work? And what that and if you don't make it yourself, if you go through a regular publisher or what I'll call them publishers, but maybe they're a label or maybe they're a studio or, you know, someone who invests in your work and helps put it in the hands of an audience, they probably tick that box for you non-negotiably. It's just a term of doing business with them that the protection box has to be ticked. What that tick box does is it adds a layer of what in technology we call the digital rights management layer to your work. And what that's supposed to do is stop people from making copies without your permission. Now, in practice, digital rights management tends not to be very good at this. Because for it to work, here's what digital rights management has to do. I make a song and I scramble it, and then I give it to you, and you have a player that unscrambles it, and I trust that that player won't let you save it so that you can play it back without the player later, so that you can give it to a friend who doesn't have the player. Because the player does all kinds of sneaky stuff. It checks to see whether you're allowed to play it right now, and if you're not, it tells you, I'm sorry, you can't play it right now. It checks to see whether you have the right key. It checks to see whether you're in the right country. I can add all kinds of conditions. You know, you can't listen to this music on a Tuesday. You can't listen to it if you're using the wrong operating system or if you're jailbroken your phone. I get to add all these conditions that might be part of my business model. And so I have to give you, the person I don't trust, a piece of software that has the key to descramble the file, and then I have to assume that you're never, ever, ever going to figure out how to get the key, and that nobody else is ever, ever, ever going to figure out how to get the key out of that program that sat in your hands and your device that you own, where I can't watch what you're doing with it. And you might not just be someone who came in to the Quaker Meeting House. You might be a board grad student with an electron tunneling microscope and a bunch of undergrads at your disposal. So this is like not a very plausible thing. All of these systems that seek to stop people from using media after we give them to them, they really kind of fail. Usually they're broken by bored Norwegian teenagers in an afternoon. And you know, that's an actual real example. The DVD stuff was broken by this kid named Jan Lek Johansson, who's now a grown-up. It's been 10 years. Along with some friends of his in Germany. And they did it in an afternoon. And DVDs have been broken basically since they came out. And it's not because the engineers are idiots. It's because they're trying to keep the safe in the bank robber's sitting room, right? It's there where the person you trust the least, who has the most tools, knowledge, and skills, can do anything they want, and you'll never know about it. And so it just doesn't work. So hiding a key in something that you're adversary owns and can inspect is an awfully dumb idea. But of course, it's illegal to break the lock anyway, thanks to laws like the EUCD, which came in 2001 and became law in the UK through the 2003 Copyright and Related Rights Regulations Act. And the other versions of this law in pretty much every industrial country in the world, as well as a lot of developing countries, because it's a treaty obligation. If you're part of the WTO, or if you're part of any of the multilateral U.S. negotiations, like CAFTA, which is the Central American Free Trade Agreement, these rules come in. So the rules are there all over the world that prohibit breaking the lock. And it doesn't stop people from breaking the locks. In fact, the easiest way to break the lock is to just find a copy that someone else has already unlocked. You go to the Pirate Bay or some other site, and you find a work that someone else has unlocked. You don't even have to be smart enough to break the lock. You just have to be smart enough to type the name of the work and add the word BitTorrent to it into your favorite search engine, and you can break the lock. So it doesn't mean that it's hard to get the work or that it's hard to break the rules, but it does mean that once Amazon or Apple or Adobe, and that's just the A's, put their locks on your copyrighted works, you lose control over it, and you lose the control over the relationship with the customer who's bought it. And that's because the rules for the digital locks, the EUCD and all their other equivalents around the world, those rules say that only the company that puts the lock on can take the lock off. So if you sell a bunch of Amazon Kindle books, a bunch of your books locked up to the Amazon Kindle format, and you and Amazon have a dispute, and you want to take your business somewhere else and sell your books now through Google Play or Apple iBooks, your readers can't turn their Kindle books into Apple books or Google books, not because it's technically challenging, but because they have to unlock it first. And in order for them to unlock it, they have to have Amazon's permission. And Amazon doesn't want to give you permission because they want to own that customer. And so as a consequence, the more you sell with someone else's lock on something, the harder it is for you to dictate terms to them. And so when the digital distributors, the retailers, the people whose only contribution to this copyright is to run the file through a small shell script, when they decide that they want a bigger piece of the pie, you have less and less negotiation leverage to push back against them. And this may sound like a hypothetical, like someday Amazon might do this to some big publisher. It's actually happening right now to one of the biggest publishers in the world. There's five big publishers left, which is a problem in and of itself. And I'll get to that in the next law. But there's five big publishers left. Three of them are owned by arms companies or companies that have an interest in arms. One of those is Hachette. And you'd think that a company that sold like cluster bombs would have a good sort of strategy and tactics approach, even if they had a howling void where their moral sensibility was supposed to be. They'd be good at strategy and tactics. But Hachette, its core tenet has been lock it all up. Not one ebook that Hachette has sold has been sold without DRM. That's their rule. It's their core principle. And so all of the Hachette ebooks ever sold at Amazon were sold with DRM. And Hachette is the first of the big five to have their standard deal with Amazon expire. And Amazon has told them that they want a lot more money from Hachette if they're going to go on selling Hachette's books. And Hachette said no. And Amazon said, fine, we don't sell your books anymore. In the U.S. anyways. It hasn't gotten to Europe yet, but it will. And that has included things like Amanda Palmer's book. It's included things like J.K. Rowling's books. And these are, you know, when there's only five publishers left, if you knock one of them out, you're going to knock out a lot of major titles. And you'd think that Hachette would have tons of negotiating leverage there. But it turns out that there's a lot of books out there and people don't want to maintain two separate libraries. Now, if Hachette had sold all of their books without DRM, it wouldn't have been any harder or easier to pirate their books. That remains easy no matter whether you use DRM or not. But what Hachette could have done the day that Amazon came along and said, we want more money or we're taking your books out of the store, they could have said, great, we're going to release an app for everybody who loves J.K. Rowling that says, would you like to read J.K. Rowling's books no matter where you bought them from? Click here to convert all of your books to Google Play Books. And by the way, all of Hachette's titles are 50% off at Google Play this week, which I think would have totally changed the negotiating leverage that Amazon could exert over Hachette. But because Hachette said, we want all of our stuff sold protected, because they allowed Amazon to put a lock on their stuff that they couldn't unlock, they've sacrificed all of their negotiating power. And it's only going to get worse from here. There's another Amazon division called Audible. If you love audiobooks, you've heard of Audible because they sell 90% of the audiobooks in the world. And it's not like Audible is run by the cuddly, nice people at Amazon and the book side is run by the mean people who want to extract as much profit as possible. Indeed, Audible has these twin advantages. The first is that it's really a pain to convert Audible books to MP3s. You have to burn them to like seven CDs that break off in the middle of a sentence and then rip them back. The other thing is that they cost a ton of money, 30, 40 pounds, some of them. And so that's a huge investment you're asking people to give up if they want to walk away from Audible. And I will bet you a testicle, not one of my testicles, but I will bet you a testicle that Amazon, within the next, say, 24 months, that Amazon will start putting the screws to all of their audio suppliers and that they will do the same thing that they've done to Hachette to everybody who sells audio. Because the other deal about Audible is that they will only sell audiobooks with Amazon's DRM on them. So with books, you get to choose. With ebooks, you get to choose. But with audiobooks, because they control so much of the market, you can't opt out of selling your copyrights in a way that locks them to Amazon's platform forever. So that's my first law. Anytime someone puts a lock on something that belongs to you and won't give you the key, that lock isn't there for your benefit. Now, my second law is that fame won't make you rich, but nobody will give you money for your stuff unless they've heard of you. Tim O'Reilly, who founded O'Reilly Media, O'Reilly and Associates, wrote the first Unix manual, coined the term Web 2.0 and open source. He's a great font of bon mots and kind of koans. And he once said, the problem for most artists isn't piracy, it's obscurity. And I think that's really resonated with a lot of people. But some people, they think that what Tim meant by that was, once you're famous, you'll be rich. And that's clearly not true. A million likes will not put braces on your kid's teeth or buy you tube fare. It takes a special alchemy to convert being loved to getting money from people. And just because people love you, it doesn't mean that they'll pay you. But unless people love you, unless people know your stuff exists and enjoy it, they absolutely will not pay you. It is a necessary but not sufficient precondition for making any money from your art. And it is, of course, possible that people might love your art and still be totally unwilling to pay you. Now, in the 21st century, the way that people discover your stuff and figure out whether they want to give you money for it is the internet. Search engines, social media, online hosting platforms like YouTube. And the way that you get paid for stuff, well, that also is the internet. It's payment processors like PayPal. It's ad brokers like Google. It's crowdfunding platforms like Kickstarter. And the internet has spawned a ton of indie successes who piece together all the functions of a traditional publisher and even sometimes a retailer from all these bits and pieces lying around on the internet. Some of them were artists who started out in the traditional publishing world and then made their way into this indie space, people like Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails or Amanda Palmer. Some of them were artists who started out as indies but then got taken into big companies, often on their own terms because they had done so well as indies they could negotiate a better deal. So Randall Monroe, who created XKCD, we have an XKCD cosplayer in the audience today, and whose What If book was number one on Amazon's charts for the 2 months before it came out. Or Hugh Howie, who wrote Wool and its sequels, who was able to negotiate a better deal with Simon & Schuster than any other Simon & Schuster author. He got to keep the ebook rights, which nobody else published with Simon & Schuster gets to do. And some are artists who started off indie and stayed indie, like Jonathan Colton, the nerd troubadour, who you may know from the song Still Alive from the end of Portal. And he's a guy who makes his living just being an indie creator. The world of big content has been seized by the same mergers and acquisitions and concentration that characterizes all of our industries, development, transportation, energy, and so on. And as with every one of those industries, the deal for everybody else in their supply chain has gotten worse, right? When there are fewer people to mediate between you and the people who want to spend money, the deal that those people can command with you gets worse. And so we now have five publishers, four labels, and four movie studios left in the world. Five movie studios, I beg your pardon, I need to correct that. Five movie studios left in the world. And when there's less competition among the buyers, the investors who invest in our creative work, then the sellers, the people who make the creative work, always get a worse deal. And the big boy standard contracts reflect that bad deal. For example, if you're a musician, your contract will almost certainly non-negotiably contain, if you sign with a big label, non-negotiably contain a clause that says every one of your royalty statements will have a percentage deducted from it for breakage. And breakage is an old line item from the era of shellac and vinyl LPs. And it reflects the percentage of records that could be reliably assumed to be shattered between the factory and the high street. And that is deducted from your royalties on your MP3 sales. And as a systems administrator, a recovering one, I can guarantee you that any number in that deduction line that is bigger than zero represents a windfall profit for the labels, because we don't break MP3s between the server and the remote end. I mean, maybe we have some packet loss, but that's not quite analogous. Not only that, novelists these days, they're being required to non-negotiably sign over world rights or audiobook rights. I've even heard of novelists with the big publishers being told non-negotiably that they have to sign over their graphic novel rights as well as their translation rights and so on. So when you have concentration, the deal gets a lot worse, because if you have to sell your graphic novel rights to your publisher, it means you can't sell them to another publisher and get paid twice. So the existence of this indie channel represents a kind of competitor of last resort to this highly concentrated entertainment industry. The worst deal that a publisher can offer you, economically speaking, has to be better than the deal you think you can get for yourself, based on the evidence of people from Trent Reznor to Hugh Howie to Jonathan Colton. The existence of an indie channel, even for the artists who don't go indie, sets the floor on the terms that publishers can offer. So it follows that the more competitive that the indie channel is, the more companies there are providing more services to artists and competing harder against each other to offer those services, the better the deal will be for artists, whether they go indie or sign to a traditional company. And the indie sector, not coincidentally, is being clobbered by the big entertainment companies. For example, Viacom said that they were upset about YouTube infringing their copyrights. And they asked the U.S. Supreme Court to interpret American copyright law to require YouTube to have a solicitor review every minute of the 96 hours of video they receive every minute of every hour of every day of every week before it could go live to the internet. Unless all of that video was vetted, then any copyright infringement that appeared in it, Google would be liable for. Now, there aren't enough solicitors alive now or in the entire history of the world to make a dent in all the video that YouTube receives in a day. I mean, we would run out of solicitor hours before we reach the heat death of the universe. And there's nothing particular about Viacom's position about Google that would theoretically exempt anyone else who let people post stuff to the internet. Their position was, if you let people post stuff to the internet, you've got to be sure they're not posting stuff that infringes copyright. And so extend the number of solicitors, the army of solicitors, the kind of infinite number of solicitors you would need to cover Twitter, to cover every blogging service, to cover Facebook, and so on, because really that's their position. Everything has to be vetted before it goes online. Well, what do they actually want? How could that possibly work? Well, either all the online providers would have to charge money to pay a solicitor to review this stuff, which would throttle it from 96 hours a minute to a much more manageable and tractable number. You'll remember that when digital cable was being mooted in the 1980s, we talked about a world in which we might someday be able to choose from up to 500 channels. Back when that seemed like an impossible universe of choice. Imagine a web that only had 500 websites on it. So, you know, that's one way you can handle it. That's how cable TV works. If you want to put something on cable TV, you've got to pay a solicitor through an insurer to make sure that this doesn't infringe copyright. So that's one thing we could do. We could dial it way back. And that would mean that the entire world of online publishing would be as expensive and as gatekept and as corrupt as the world of cable is today, where if you're rich or under the protection of a huge company, you get exposure, but if you aren't, you don't. And there are a number of excitingly sinister closed-door trade negotiations all around the world that seek to extend this regime of liability to people who host content or people who take money or people who broker ads. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, as well as in the UK we have these homegrown enforcement actions. The City of London Police invented an entire body of law that has no recourse to statute, by which they just go around and shut down websites. And then they write officious-sounding letters to registrars in other countries saying that they have to shut down whole domains without a court order, without any statutory basis. They just decided that because they're the police force of the finance center of the world, they get to sort of invent their own internet laws. And ironically, the person in charge of all of this has said that we are at a crossroads in which we have to decide whether we want a lawless internet or a lawful internet, seemingly so irony impaired that he can't appreciate that making up your own laws is not lawfulness. And just as digital rights management doesn't stop people from making copies, all of this intermediary liability business where you try to stop those copies from spreading, it doesn't make it any harder to find it. What we call the darknet, all those websites that are much harder to find and harder to enforce against, is pretty much immune to this sort of thing. And there are innumerable channels for getting this stuff online. After all, the way that the internet works is by making copies. An internet that makes copies worse is like water that gets less wet. The way that we know that the internet is working is if it makes copies faithfully and cheaply and reliably. And if someone tries to interfere with it, the copy tries again and again. So all this does is reduce the diversity and the competitiveness in this sector of services to indie creators, which means that it makes it harder for you to get a deal out of your investor to make your work known so that someone will give you money for it. Because fame won't make you rich, but no one will give you money until they've heard of your stuff. So those are the first two laws. And you might think of them in summary as, you know, if you want a kind of TLDR for them. The first one is just because you're on their side doesn't mean they're on your side, part one. The second one is just because you're on their side doesn't mean they're on your side, part two. But this is the most important law. This is law number three, and it's the title of the talk, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free. Now, you may have heard that this whole discussion about copyright and the internet is all about the question of whether or not information wants to be free. And I wanted to settle this question. So I invited Information away for a kind of drumming retreat in the Cotswolds. And we hired a cabin in the woods. We built a fire. We drank oaky Chardonnay. We told stories about our childhood and cried about our parents. And when it was all over, Information gave me a long, soulful, manly hug, and as its stubble rasped my cheek, it whispered its secret in my ear. Information does not want to be free. It doesn't want anything at all from us except for us to stop anthropomorphizing information. Because information is an abstraction, and it doesn't want anything from us. I haven't devoted my whole life to this stuff because I care about what the notional desires of abstract ideas. This is a fight about people, and people want to be free. And in the information age, the way that you make people free is by having free and fair information infrastructure. When we focus on how we make the internet safe for the not 1% of people who've won the creative industry lottery, we treat the net as though it was a glorified video on demand service. But the internet is not a glorified video on demand service. The internet is the nervous system of the 21st century through which all of our activities are increasingly mediated. Everything we do today involves the net, and everything we do tomorrow will require the net. So while it's true that DRM is a bad deal for creators, publishers, and audiences, that's just a sideshow. The real cost of digital rights management is that in order to shore it up, virtually every country in the world has a law that says you can't tell people information that would be useful to help them remove the digital locks, to help them unlock their stuff. And that means that anyone who tells you about a flaw in any device or system you have that has copyrighted works on it, which is everything, anyone who tells you about a flaw in those works potentially commits a crime, because that flaw can be used to figure out how to cleverly remove the lock. That's, in fact, how those locks are removed. But that also means that the devices that we rely upon as a matter of life and limb are being turned into lifelong reservoirs of pathogens that can be used to act against the people who rely on them. They can be exploited by creeps and cops and voyeurs and identity thieves and spies and governments around the world. Because the world is made of computers. Your car is a computer that speeds you down the road at 70 miles an hour. A modern building is a computer. It's basically a giant case mod that we happen to sit inside of. If you take all the computers out of most modern buildings, they cease to know how to respirate, and because of their insulation qualities, they start to mold up, they start to become too humid. If you leave the computers out for any length of time, that building will be permanently uninhabitable. And it's just a tear down at that point, black mold going up the walls. And it's not just that we put our bodies in computers, although we do that everywhere and all the time. I'm going to New York Comic Con with a new book on Friday, and I just saw that I'm flying on a Boeing 747. And a Boeing 747 is my favorite airplane because I know what its control system is. It's a Flying Sun Solaris workstation in a very fancy aluminium case connected to some tragically badly secured SCADA controllers. And I'm going to put my body in it, and it's going to fly halfway across the world. I'm changing the climate. Ask me how. And it's not just that we put computers in our bodies increasingly, or we put our bodies in computers increasingly, it goes the other way around. You and me and everyone we know who've grown up with iPods or Walkmans, we have logged enough punishing earbud hours that there will come a day, if we're not hit by a car, you know, felled by Ebola first, there will come a day when we will need a hearing aid, and it's vanishingly unlikely that that will be a beige, retro, hipster, analog, transistorized hearing aid. It's going to be a computer that you put in your body. It might be owned by the NHS. We might have a home secretary who decides that it's got to tell her everything that it hears. It might be able to stop you from hearing things that are there. It might be able to make you hear things that aren't there, depending on how it's designed. I, as you may have gathered, spent a lot of time in airplane lounges, and the first law of the frequent flyer is ABC, always be charging. And so I got to an airport lounge, and I ran over to the single mains outlet, and I plugged my laptop in. And about 15 minutes later, a man came in, and very cheekily, he asked me if he could use the electrical outlet. And I kind of looked over my glasses at him, and I said, I'm charging my laptop. And he rolled up his trouser leg and showed me his robotic knee down prosthesis. And he said, I need to charge my leg before the flight. And I said, this is all yours. So stacking the deck against disclosure of flaws in the devices that we rely on for everything, is an insane idea. You should be allowed to know about the flaws in your iPhone, a device that has a camera, a microphone, a location sensor, and that knows who all your friends are, what you talk to them about, and where you go with them, even if doing so makes it harder for Apple to make sure that they get 30% every time someone buys an app for it. But because you need to jailbreak an iPhone in order to buy an app from a third party, then telling people about flaws in iPhones is itself legally fraught. And when it comes to the increasing liability for service providers, the major effect has nothing to do with the arts. The 96 hours of video landing in YouTube's ingesters every minute aren't amateur movies or pirate TV. They're personal communications. They're dialogue. They're dissident footage from war zones. They're the raw stuff of communications. And that's same for tweets and Facebook posts and the whole lot. And this is where somebody often says, oh, but all that stuff is rubbish, isn't it? It's just cat pictures, which is really the height of arrogance. After all, when my wife comes down to the kitchen in the morning and I ask her how she slept, it's not because I don't know the answer. I sleep next to my wife. When she has a bad night, I know about it before she comes down for breakfast. Nor is the answer going to be important in some objective sense. No one else cares about the answer either. But it's a coded message in a very easily cracked cipher. When you ask someone who you love when they come down to breakfast how they slept, what you're saying is, I love you, I'm thinking of you, I'm glad to be here with you. And it's through the substrate of millions of these so-called meaningless moments that all of our social meaning is grown. To dismiss the personal as banal is to miss the point. The reason other people's pointless communications seem pointless to you is because they're not intended for you. We've set up this system where any file can be removed from the internet merely by pointing at it and saying, that infringes my copyright, without any evidence and virtually no penalties for any abuse. This notice and takedown regime is used by the copyright industries, but it's also routinely abused by every kind of bully, from the King of Thailand enforcing his lese majeste against dissidents in Thailand to homegrown neo-Nazis here in the UK. Because if you set up a system of censorship without any due process and without any penalties for abuse, you'd be criminally naive not to expect it to be widely abused. And in the US, they followed our example here in the last parliament, the last day of the last parliament, before they prorogued for the election campaign. They had a session, a special session that's held in every parliament just before the elections called the wash-up. And it's a short session with virtually no debate, and it's a session through which Parliament's station-keeping legislation is passed. Like, you know, how do we keep the civil service paid? How do we keep the lights on? How do we keep the trains running while we're all out stumping for re-election? So they had this very brief session. It's very lightly attended. It's barely quorate because most politicians are already back in their home constituencies trying to make sure they have a job in a month. And by tradition, only non-technical, non-controversial legislation is debated. But in the last Parliament, in the last hour of the last parliament, they passed a bill called the Digital Economy Act with almost no parliamentary debate. And the DEA it was very technical. Tom Watson is a Labour MP, very, very long-serving MP, called it the most technical legislation he'd ever been asked to vote on. No parliamentary debate. And it had a secondary legislation that allows our business secretaries, who have been, frankly, a long-standing shower of terribleness. It allows the business secretary at their whim to establish rules that allow them to take away a family's internet access if they're accused of three acts of piracy without any kind of formal adversarial court proceeding. And in the U.S., they followed this, not by making a law, but by making a voluntary policy through the so-called IP czar of the Obama White House, Victoria Espinel, who's just quit to go work for a big copyright lobbyist, as often happens. And the major ISPs there opted into pretty much the same thing. And what this means is that merely by living in the vicinity of a Wi-Fi access point that some unknown party may or may not have used to watch telly the wrong way, you are denied access to the internet. Now, there's a woman in the UK who's had successively the two coolest job titles I've ever heard of. Her current job title is the most Dungeons and Dragonsy thing I've ever heard. She's the Baroness of Soho. Before that, she was the Champion for Digital Inclusion, which is also a super cool job title, Champion for Digital Inclusion. And her name's Martha Lane Fox. And when she got the Champion job, she commissioned PricewaterhouseCoopers to do a study on what happens when people get internet access, because she's trying to include people on the internet. She wants to find out what happens. And she had a kind of lucky living lab, an A-B split out there in the wild that she could use to test it, because there were council estates that had been given free internet access for a couple of years as a pilot program, and then there were other council estates near them that hadn't, just because they were a little further away from, you know, where the wiring closet was. You know, not because one council estate was full of people who were super into the internet and the other one wasn't. It was just luck of the draw. So here you have two very similar populations with a major difference in them is that one of them's had a couple of years worth of internet. And, you know, going in, you would expect that the internet, well, maybe their kids would get better grades or, you know, maybe they'd be a little more better informed. But everything changed for these people. Everything we use to measure the success of a Western modern society, a good government, changes when you give people the internet for the better. They had better nutrition, they had more disposable income, better jobs, their kids did have better grades, and they were more likely to go on to tertiary education and were more socially mobile. They were more civically engaged, more likely to go out and volunteer in their community. They were more politically aware, more likely to vote. So really what we're prepared to say is that on the strength of a vote with no debate, we will take away the single wire that delivers free speech, a free press, access to education, to tools, to ideas, to community, to freedom of assembly, to nutrition, to employment, to social mobility, to all of those things. We'll take them all away if you happen to live too close to a piece of equipment that someone may or may not have used to watch telly the wrong way. When we as a society are prepared to collectively punish whole families who are accused of being entertained without permission by severing them from that wire, then it's clear as day that this is not a fight about information, but about people. Now, I happen to believe that I can earn my living without having to spy on everyone, without being granted censorship authority over the internet, without a system as manifestly unfair as Peter Mandelson's grotesque Digital Economy Act. But even if I wasn't, I would still fight for a free and fair internet, because as much as I've dreamt all my life of being a writer, I'm far more interested in bequeathing a fair world to my daughter than I am in going on earning a living making up stories. There are millions of ways to make money from the arts and trillions of ways to go broke in the arts. Ensuring that artists who do succeed get their fair share of the money is a noble goal, but even more than that, artists should always be opposed to censorship and surveillance and control, because the arts should never be on the side of that stuff. Try anything and everything to get your coin to land edge on, but if you plan on breaking the net to accomplish it, then I think you're on the wrong side of history. So I helped found an organization called the Open Rights Group. I'm sure many of you are members. I hope more of you will be members when you leave tonight. And it was founded to take some of the issues that organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, whom I hope you'll also support, have fought for on the global stage. And it's these issues. It's not a question of whether information wants to be free. It's a question of whether or not our government is going to treat the signal policy lever of our century with the gravitas that it deserves. Not as a system for recruiting jihadis, not as a pornography distribution system, not as a way to watch telly, but as the nervous system of the 21st century. And ORG has been incredibly successful. It has grown beyond my wildest dreams, and I can say that without being egotistical, because I've had almost nothing to do with it, apart from being wheeled out periodically to talk at things like this. It's all the volunteers and staffers at ORG who've done it, and we've just hired our first solicitor to intervene in the courts in important cases about this stuff. So I hope you'll get involved with ORG. There's lots of literature outside, as well as free stickers. I just found one that I hadn't seen before, Privacy Not Prism. That's going on my laptop. I hope you'll get involved and talk to the volunteers and staffers who are here tonight. And thank you all very much for coming. I'll take your questions now. I'll remind you in advance that long rambling statements followed by "what do you think of that" is technically a question, but not good ones. Thank you. Right, who's got a question? Yeah.
You were talking about disconnection from through the Digital Economy Act. I was just wondering if you know how many cases of disconnection there have been.
They have not enacted the secondary legislation yet.
Right.
So it's there, it's kind of lurking in potentia. It can come in at some other point.
The French have had a particularly awful.
Yeah, and that collapsed. They sent out lots and lots of warnings, but it turned out that they fell victim to another underlying problem, or another facet of the same underlying problem, which is the corruption problem. Larry Lessig talks about corruption as kind of the underlying problem of all of this stuff, industrial lobbying as the thing that makes it. And so the supplier that they paid an ungodly amount of money to manage their disconnection service in France was magnificently corrupt and cost them all kinds of money and and was so wildly inefficient that they shut it down, not really about the whether or not it was effective with copyright, but mostly because of the outrage at the gross corruption of this government contractor. They only managed, as I recall, only one disconnection in France. And that disconnection was for someone whom even the courts admitted had not done the downloading. It was his ex-wife who admitted that she'd done it, who no longer lived in his house, but because it was his access point, they fined him. They didn't disconnect him. A much more grave case is New Zealand, where they passed Bill 92A, which was the disconnection bill, around a flurry of lobbying that seems to have been related to the deal to get the Hobbit movies, the Tolkien movies, shot in New Zealand. And it was passed again with virtually no debate, and there was a huge political uprising in New Zealand. It's the cool thing about small countries is that small numbers of people make huge differences to elected politicians' futures, and it actually got struck off the books. And it was, and they were going to reconsider it in the next parliament, and then the Christchurch earthquake hit, and Parliament reconvened for an emergency session, and a parliamentarian who'd presumably been inveigled by a lobbyist added a rider to the emergency aid bill for the people lying in the rubble of Christchurch that said the bill couldn't pass unless they also reinstated the three strikes rule, which is just about as depraved as it gets. I mean, really, that's just, I mean, you know, you write that into a science fiction novel, they'd say, phew, couldn't you make the villain a little more believable? Other questions? Yeah.
Just thinking about the whole bill about the Three Strikes Act. Mm-hmm. Couldn't you make it illegal because the amount of digitalization currently going on in government wouldn't just mean that you would disconnect someone from the internet, but you would also disconnect someone from public services?
Well, I absolutely think that is what happens when you disconnect someone from the internet. It's really the death penalty for the information society. And I, you know,
well, not only for the information society, but for if you want to have jobs,
well, sure, yeah,
you have to go on the internet to
And so this is the premise of a novel I wrote called Pirate Cinema, which is about a kid who downloads movies to remix them, but gets his family's knocked off, and they can't sign on for benefits anymore, and his sister can't finish her exams, and his father can't do his job anymore because it's a teleworking job, and so on. We're not far off from that. I mean, the internet is really that one wire that delivers everything. There's certainly not going to be a future in which being disconnected from the internet is less harmful to your future, right? It only gets worse from here. So, you know, the fact that we have secondary legislation that hasn't been enacted is no comfort, because if they enact it later, you know, now that it's on the books, it can be enacted at the business secretary's say-so. If they enact it later, it will only be worse than it would have been if they had enacted it back when they passed it in 2010. And it really just does get worse. It was a three-line whip, by the way. All the major parties said, effectively, you're out of a job. We're going to withdraw the whip from you. You'll have to campaign as an independent. And election campaigning starts this afternoon, unless you vote for this. So it was a stitch-up all the way down. And it was the major parties, you know. And neither one of the two major parties, nor the one that came in the coalition, have been any better on this. In fact, the Lib Dem Lords introduced some of the worst amendments to the Digital Economy Act. So the three major parties right now in England and Wales and Northern Ireland are not great on this. I don't know where the SNP stands. Yeah.
Your nonfiction and your talk tonight is great at documenting the stranglehold that big corporations are increasingly having over information on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Your fictional books, on the other hand, are full of people changing the world, you know, taking action successfully, radically, you know, making radical progress and so on. Is that the split that we're going to see, you know,
we're
going to have change in the real world.
Well, so people often ask me if I'm pessimistic or optimistic about the future. And I try not to make predictions about the future, because as a science fiction writer, I understand that believing that you can predict the future has the same relationship to writing science fiction that sampling the product does to selling drugs. It never ends well. And if we could predict the future, what would be the point, right? It's all foreordained. Why bother if the future is predictable? So rather than pessimism or optimism, I have what I think you can only call hope. And hope is, you know, if your ship sinks in the middle of the open water, you tread water until you run out of energy, not because it's likely that you'll be picked up, but because everyone who's ever been picked up treaded water. And most of the ones who treaded water sank, but the only chance you have is to do this. And, you know, this stuff to me doesn't alarm me, because I think it will make things a bit worse in the future. I think that equipping our homes and our devices, equipping our bodies and the things that we put our bodies into with this kind of policy regime is a future that is like dystopian on a kind of horrific scale. And the reason I fight about it is because, you know, it's untenable to imagine that we will actually, that something won't change between now and then. And the only way I know for something to change is for people to try and change it, right? I don't think it's going to change on its own. I think if we just wait for the winds to blow the other direction. I mean, yes, history has a pendulum that blows backwards and forwards, but it has a pendulum that blows backwards and forwards because people are pushing it. And so we have to push it. And we have to push it not because we'll necessarily succeed, but because we will necessarily fail if we don't. And so, yeah, my books are full of people who take hope but never win total victories. In fact, I've gotten into lots of arguments with my editors about this. My little brother, my first young adult novel, which involves a 17-year-old who takes up digital arms against the Department of Homeland Security, my editor wanted him to win in the end. And I'm like, he's not going to win. Like, the Department of Homeland Security isn't going to go away at the end of this book. He's 17, right? You know, maybe he won't go to jail. I think that's the happy ending. You know, spoiler alert. That's the happy ending I'm shooting for. Maybe he won't go to jail. But he can't win because that's not plausible that he'll win. The future is not a thing that you win. It's a thing where you marshal forces to try and make it as good as possible and put everything you can into those forces while other people marshal their energy into counter forces that they think will make the future as good as possible, but they're wrong. And that's the kind of thing that the future is. It's not a trophy. It's a, as they say about security, it's a process, not a product. Yeah.
So I was interested in your mention of the council estate there, where people had access to
the internet. Yeah.
Okay. So, how do you think we can encourage an uptake for an open internet society? Because I'm going to ramble on a little bit here, just for.
Yeah, sure, go.
I kind of see a two-speed internet going on, where people get closed devices, they get apps on mobile phones that give them access to kind of walled gardens.
Mm-hmm.
People in poorer estates, when that's how they access the internet, is that they have limited bandwidth or limited data plans. Mm-hmm. But that seems to be the way things are going for.
I agree. I mean, I think the question of network neutrality is a really important one. And you know, it's not just important for the reasons you just articulated, which is that concentration in the telecom sector leads to terrible potential for abuse and privation and so on, and not merely for the anti-competitive effects, where in the States you've seen these arguments about carriers who want to privilege one kind of video over another. Basically, unless they get a bribe, they won't carry, you know, one company's video or another. It's, you know, when you call the pizzeria on the corner, you expect the phone to ring at the pizzeria on the corner, assuming it's not engaged. You don't want a recording to come on that says, you know, Joe's Pizzeria has not paid for premium coverage. Press 1 now to be connected immediately to Domino's, or hold for 1 minute. I mean, we understand that why you pay for the internet is to connect you to the services you want, but those aren't the serious problems. The serious problem is that the concentration in the sector means that when GCHQ wants to wiretap the whole internet, it just needs to put down like 3 fiber taps and suborn 3 or 4 companies into helping it. And we saw with some of the Snowden leaks that BT and the other major telcos were complicit in it. And when they want to enact a system of extrajudicial national censorship, where websites voluntarily start blocking, are voluntarily blocked by ISPs, they only have to go to a few ISPs. This is how the US IPs are managed to get their 6-strike system, which is like the 3-strike system implemented without a law, is that there's so few ISPs, and they're so concentrated, and they're so responsive to the kind of quid pro quo from regulators who, well, if you give us a bit of this, we'll give you a bit of that. And they all have the same incentive structures and the same business model, that it's really easy for this stuff to come through. In the UK, we are a little bit better off because we still have line sharing. And so independent ISPs can go in and line share with BT and get on BT's lines. Unfortunately, it all involves OpenReach, which, if you've ever waited all day for someone to come in and not fix things, you know what OpenReach is like. But you know, in the UK, I signed up after just getting fed up with BT and their participation in network censorship. I signed up with an ISP that a friend recommended called Andrews and Arnold. Who, full disclosure, I understand they're sponsoring an org event. I had nothing to do with that. They've never given me anything. I give them money every month. But Andrews and Arnold is run by sysadmins. Their policy on active opt-out is, which is the thing where if you, when you sign up with an ISP, unless you tell them that you want the unfiltered internet, they have to censor the internet for you, as though somewhere in the world there's either a room full of prudes big enough that they can look at all the web pages and sort the good ones from the bad, or a regular expression so subtle and complex that it can sort the bad web pages from the good. And their response was, well, if we have to have a meaningful alternate, like a meaningful opt-out policy, here it is. Andrews and Arnold doesn't believe in this policy. If you want to get a censored internet, you shouldn't be an Andrews and Arnold customer. And as soon as I saw that, I signed up with Andrews and Arnold. So, and I moved my business onto them too. So I really like them. In terms of this walled garden thing, I think it's a huge problem. I do think that people who are more resource constrained, people who are poorer, are extremely price sensitive. And to the extent that the open systems are cheaper, they are often more attractive to people who are more pressured for money. So, for example, the only people I know who have two SIM phones, phones that can have two SIMs in them at once, are the ladies who are horribly underpaid who work at my daughter's old daycare. And they do that because you can sign up with one carrier and get unlimited SMS and the other one and get unlimited calls to your best mates. And so for them, who are cash poor and relatively time rich, figuring out how to make this stuff work, because it's not rocket science, it's just fugly, right? A phone with two SIM cards. It's got extra buttons on the front. You kind of got to practice a bit. But it's not like you're learning how to perform braid surgery. You're just learning how to, you know, decode some badly thought out electronics. It's something that all of us do from the cradle on. And they're willing to do it because they're so price sensitive. You see this a lot with OAPs as well. You know, my grandfather was figuring out how to, you know, split cable into multiple rooms in his house, even though it required lots of arcane things because they were making the transition to digital and they were introducing all these countermeasures because they wanted to charge you for every cable box. And, you know, he's on a fixed income. He's sitting around the house all day. He's got nothing to do but figure out how to make this work. And it makes sense for him to do it. So to a certain extent, I think that there's an element of self-correction here, provided that there are open devices and open systems that are a cheaper alternative. And Lawrence Lessig, he talks about the four forces that regulate our society. One of them is code, right? What systems are available and how they work. One of them is laws. One of them is markets. And one of them is norms. And I think that one of the major problems of the rules about jailbreaking is that it distorts both the norms and the markets because it's a bad law. So under normal circumstances, if Apple said, if you want to sell an app to go on an iPhone, you have to give us 30%, you would expect a competitor to come into the market and say, we'll do it for 15, right? But because it's against the law to make that store, Apple gets to control it. And we have a certain normative sense that it's right and proper. If I sold you the device, I should be able to tell you what you can do with it. And your only remedy is to buy a different device. It's, you know, we wouldn't say that about toasters, right? If I sold you the toaster, I don't get to specify the bread. If I sold you the dishwasher, I don't get to specify the dishes. But our normative view of what iPhones can and can't do is shifting. And what's right and proper for electronics is shifting because of these restrictions in the market. And I think that, you know, legislative reform could really change it. If we had legislative reform that allowed multiple parties to offer stores, it would become as natural to buy your apps from more than one place as it is to buy your bread from more than one place. It's, you know, it's not a crazy thing. And I think we'd get better code too. In the world of open and free systems for privacy, I think we're actually seeing some real movement now, which is great. I think for a long time, those four forces didn't work in our favor. For a long time, tools that provided privacy presume that you are very technically sophisticated, not because privacy is itself transcendently hard, but to understand that what your data trail looks like on the internet and how it could harm you required a fairly technically sophisticated understanding of the overall picture of how the internet worked. And as a consequence, the only market, the only demand for privacy tools were from people who are already super geeky. And so all the tools assumed a super geekiness. It's a bit like desktop publishing, right? There are some intractably technical elements of typesetting and the things that separate brilliant typesetting from quotidian typesetting, that like decimal 5% that nobody but a highly trained typesetter can do. But before desktop publishing, all typesetting software assumed that you had the entire technical knowledge of typesetting. And after desktop publishing, 99.5% of desktop publishing was turned into something that normal people could use. And it doesn't mean that there aren't things that you need to be a great typesetter to do, but it does mean that there's a huge amount of space between stuff that's not designed at all and stuff that's designed by a pro that's now been occupied by other people. And our privacy tools are starting to move in that direction because of Snowden. 3 months after the Snowden leaks last September, or September before last, September 2013, the Pew Internet Research Group did a report on, Pew Internet Life Research Report, did a report on American attitudes towards privacy, and they found that 87% of Americans in the 3 months since the Snowden disclosures had taken some affirmative step to protect their privacy, but none of it had done any good, right? Because like none of the tools for normal people have a tick box that gives them more privacy, right? Like every one of those tick boxes on the Facebook privacy configurator gives you less privacy, right? They're like the lines on the craps table. The only reason they're there is to make it hard for you to figure out what the odds are, right? And the thing is that when 87% of American internet users want a product that nobody is giving them and that product is legal, all of a sudden people start making that product. And so both in the nonprofit and for-profit sector, there's tons of work on privacy tools for normal people that assume that you aren't technically knowledgeable, that you are resource constrained, that you don't have a super powerful computer. And that's great. I think that it opens the door to a much better future and a much better future in terms of the walled gardens too, because privacy is a team sport, right? I maintain my own mail server. I've done so for forever. Like you know, I think a lot of founding org members are the kind of people who ran their own mail servers, but everybody we correspond with has their mail on Gmail. And so it doesn't matter that all of our mail is sitting on unciphered hard drives and secure data centers, because it's also sitting where Eric Schmidt, who is a colossal privacy jerk, will give it to the secret police of the world. And so until we get everybody else also playing along, our private information will also be in public places. Yeah?
I just wonder what your view is on Aral Balkan and the indie tech movement.
On which?
Aral Balkan and his indie tech concept.
Oh, Aral and his indie tech. I don't know a whole ton about it. I saw him present once at Hacker News in London, and I don't remember enough about it. I do think that the idea of indie tech is a great idea. That stuff made by smaller firms and more competitive firms is a great idea. That to me makes an enormous amount of sense as a creator, because I think that the more firms there are competing to sell my stuff, the better terms I'll get out of them. It also makes sense to me as someone worried about surveillance, because the more firms there are that you have to arm twist into helping you surveil everybody, the harder it is to surveil everybody. But I don't remember the details. I remember that there was some sort of thing where indie tech was cool and important, but you could also do it with iOS. And that was the part where I couldn't figure out where he was going with it. But I think his point was that with Apple, you're not the product, and with Google, you are. And I think that there's an element of that that's true. But I actually think that if you can't tell what Apple is doing, in other words, if you can't ask someone more knowledgeable than you, or if you're that knowledgeable, to look at Apple's code, you just have to rely on them to not lie about whether or not they're giving your information to someone else. And I would much rather have a system that works even if you don't trust the company providing it. And I think that's the missing piece with Errol's analysis. And it's why I use a version of Android called CyanogenMod that's an open version where other people can look at the code. I, frankly, don't have the expertise to audit the code, but other people do. And they can miss things. I mean, we just had the Shell Shock, and before that we had Heartbleed. But the reason we know about Shell Shock and Heartbleed is because lots of people can look at that code, right? We don't know what's lurking in the proprietary equivalents of Shell Shock and Heartbleed unless we're spies or unless we're criminals, in which case we probably do. But the rest of the public never will, because, you know, until another Snowden comes out and tells you about it, you know, we won't. It just seems unlikely that, like, Apple doesn't make any mistakes or never lies. That neither of those things seem like a good bet. Yeah.
One of the really difficult things in the civil rights campaign is convincing people that privacy is actually a good thing. And you hear the mantra, nothing to fear, nothing to hide.
Mm-hmm.
And contrasting arguments that actually break that apart, it's quite difficult. I was wondering if you could
begin. Yeah, so... All right, the question is about privacy and nothing to fear, nothing to hide, and articulating the case for privacy to people who haven't understood it. And I think that there's different kinds of arguments we can make about privacy. One is breaking down the difference between privacy and secrecy. Privacy is not nobody knowing your business. Privacy is you deciding who gets to know your business. And there's an enormous amount of what we do that isn't secret, but is stuff that we would prefer to limit who gets to know about it, maybe just to us. Like, I know what everybody in this room does when they go to the toilet, but most of us want to be able to close the door when we go there. It takes a very special person to want to do it out in front of everybody else. All of your parents did something that is not a secret, but was very private to make you. And even though it's not a secret, most of us want to do it somewhere where other people can't watch maybe unless we choose who they are. But you know, not being able to choose who watches is generally considered kind of the sine qua non of like living in a bad situation. And so there may be stuff that you want to do that's not a secret, but is private. One of the things that you might want to do that's not a secret but is private is make mistakes. So I have a young daughter. She's 6.5. And both the highest and lowest moments of my parenting career have been when I've seen her doing something that's like right at the limits and beyond her ability, where she's like drawing something or building something or doing something that is wonderful to watch because she's really giving it her all, and to watch really closely and then to notice her noticing me and then to watch her stop doing it, because nobody wants to make mistakes in front of other people, right? Our entire intellectual development, our entire development as people, our development of ideas in our society starts with people being able to talk about ideas in a private register. So not just that, not totally private, not just in your own head, but maybe you and a friend talk something through. You talk through an idea, you talk through an interaction. You say, is so-and-so angry at me? All of those things are things that are not secret per se, but they're private and they're critical to our development as people and to our ability to conduct a normal social round, right? If the only way you could resolve misunderstandings would be to blare all of your questions and doubts from the top of your roof, our misunderstandings wouldn't all be magically resolved. They would fester. And so that's another piece of it. And then the last piece is maybe you really do have nothing to hide, right? Maybe you have lucked into being like so white and so het and so cis and so healthy and so everything that there is nothing compromising about you. And if you did get there, you got there not because of any special virtue of your own, but because you got incredibly, extraordinarily lucky. And it's a dead certainty that someone that you love, your kids or your brothers, your sisters, your parents, did not win the lottery the way you did. And the only way those people can have the privacy that they need to have their lives, which needs to have some private elements through no fault of their own, is if everybody uses privacy. Because if the only people who insist on privacy are people with something to hide, then those people will be compromised. And so it's our duty as people who think that they have nothing to hide to anyways practice privacy. So I think those are my arguments for privacy. Maybe we'll take one more question. Yeah, go ahead.
You mentioned you've got a 6-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. The approach that schools advocate, and mm-hmm. we get from the governments and the media for kids and computers and the internet, is to set everything up so that you know exactly what they're doing, you can monitor them, you can see everything they're doing.
Yeah.
Do you take that approach? And at what age do you think you'd consider teaching your children how to have roofs on their machines, how to lock you out, how to set their machines up so that you can't actually access?
It's a great question. So these are questions I don't know the answer to yet, because I haven't gotten there yet. But my daughter, you know, there's a laptop that she can use in the house that's an old laptop that she does scratch on. She steals our tablets all the time to watch YouTube. And I've got her set up with an email account so she can email her grandparents and so on. She can peck out, you know, words. And it's quite nice to see her getting involved with this, especially when she does more creative things with Scratch and so on. What I've done since the very beginning, because we've always had tablets and phones around the house, and she, from a very early age, started using them to look at cartoons. And what I always did was just make sure I was in the room when she was doing it so that I could just keep one ear open, because there was this normal pattern that we had with cartoons where she would say, Daddy, put on Peppa Pig. And I put on Peppa Pig. And at the end, there's some suggestive videos. And she was illiterate at the time. So although that sounds like such a terrible thing to say about your kid. She couldn't read yet. So she would tap one of the other ones, and it would be like Peppa Pig in French. And then it'd be Peppa Pig in Russian. And then it'd be Peppa Pig with someone violently swearing. And in those times, like, she never said, like, Daddy, let me listen to the swearing. It was that would be the point at which she'd always bring me the tablet and say, can you put it back on Peppa Pig in English again, and we'll start, you know, working our way out through the adjacent possibles of the Peppa Pig recommendation engine. And that was great until one day I heard something coming from the tablet that was a commercial, and it was a Mattel ad for Barbie, and it was this crazy ad. It was like a 5-year-old girl with tons of Barbie stuff. It was not an ad that ever appeared on telly, and she was enumerating in a kind of pornography her Barbie collection and how great each piece was. It was like the Home Shopping Channel for 5-year-olds. And my daughter was riveted by this. And I went over, I was like, that sounds like an advert. You're not supposed to be watching adverts. And she said, no, it's just a show. And I'm like, no, that's definitely an advert. And I took it away. And for weeks later, she was like, do you remember, Daddy, there was that show about the Barbies? And so there's not a parental filter in the world that would block that, right? And so there is no substitute for kind of being around when you can. And what I reckon is that being around, I don't know what the answer to this is, because first of all, whatever the answer to it is now won't be the answer in 5 years, because it'll be a different internet in 5 years. So I don't know what the answer is, but I think that the whatever that answer is will involve her first having the confidence to use technology well. Second of all, having the good sense to know when she's out of her depth. And third of all, having the trust in me to come back and talk to me when she gets out of her depth. And the reason that works a lot better than just putting locks on everything is because it fails well, right? If your major defense against your computer being misused by your kid is putting locks on it, well, your kid is cash poor and time rich, and we'll figure out how to undo those locks, and then your system has totally failed. Whereas a system grounded in this kind of dynamic, responsive, human intelligence-infused path has a chance of failing more gracefully. I don't think that I can stop her from seeing every bad thing on the internet in the same way. You know, we live in a neighborhood that is... has a lot of clubs in it, and so when we go out in the morning on a Saturday, there's drunk people, and there's also vomit, and there's also sometimes human poos, and we walk down the street and she sees these things, right? And I can't shield her from them. I do try to cross the street and make sure she doesn't. We try to take routes where we avoid them, but sometimes she sees them and she asks me about them, and I give her age appropriate answers. And basically, what I'm hoping is that by the time she's old enough to walk out to the shops on her own, that all of that stuff will have been internalized to the point where she can be safe and not traumatized and talk to me if something bad happens. Because it's the real world, and the real world is full of things that are not kid-safe too, and the internet's just part of the real world, and it has non-kid-safe things as well. And so really I think like the thing that I focus on is confidence instead of fear. She started an ICT unit in year two this year. She's in a state school in Hackney, and she came home the other day, and she has email. She uses it to email my parents and stuff, and she said, I'm not allowed to do messaging anymore because I'm not allowed to message with anyone on the internet. I'm like, you can message with your grandparents, kid. And she said, no, I'm not allowed. And I'm like, you are totally allowed to message with your grandparents. It's all right. And I just don't know that fear... I think that she will learn much better habits from messaging with her grandparents and finding out what normal email looks like, so that when bullying email or other inappropriate email crops up, she'll know that this isn't how you're supposed to use email, than by just having this total prohibition on it. And, you know, grandparents are great stabilizers, you know, great training wheels for learning how to use this stuff. That kind of communication and messaging is a really good first cut at it. But I don't know what the answer is going to be in 5 years. I mean, I heard Mimi Ito, who's a great scholar of how young people use the internet. She runs the MacArthur Digital Youth Project. And it's this huge study of how teenagers use the internet. And she came into a presentation at a thing I was running once, and someone asked her, what are iPads doing to our brains? And she said, well, this is a question that people really grapple with. And the thing is, whatever iPads are doing to your brains, you probably have to wait at least 10 years to find out. And by that point, there won't be iPads anymore. So as a question, it's mostly academic in the kind of most pejorative sense of the word. Because by the time you found out, there will be too late to intervene. So that's kind of my roundabout answer about the impossible business of trying to parent a kid in the internet era, which is probably as impossible as the automotive era and the locomotive era and the, you know, the time when you had to deal with the pressure of whether you sent them down the chimney when they were 7 or 5 and down the coal mines, that sort of thing. All right, well, thank you all very, very much. There's org literature outside. I don't know what happens next. Tell us what happens next.
Take a round of applause.
Thank you.
So I just want to say a few words about Open Rights Group Sheffield and the Open Rights Group and what we do. We're basically a campaigning organisation for civil rights, and we campaign against anything which is the intersection between human rights and digital world. So all the things that Corey's been talking about tonight, that's all what we campaign about. We're trying to make a better world. We're trying to fix all these problems through the world. And we've got a lot of resources with org. We've got lawyers. We're running software projects. We're running a project to called block.org, which is to help you to find out sites which are censored on the internet. So we have a lot of resources that we can help, try to make these things better. In Sheffield, we are trying to promote discussion about these issues and get people interested. And we hold monthly meetings, normally on the second Wednesday of every month. Our next meeting, which is the flyer on your chairs, is all about privacy, personal privacy tools that you can use. So this is all about why you should be exercising privacy on the internet and the tools that can help you do that. We've also campaigned about things like medical confidentiality, internet censorship, the NSA and the surveillance from GCHQ. And basically, if there's anything that you want to cover in these meetings, anything particularly that falls under the things I've talked about, then we can hold a talk on that and come and talk to me about it, and we can schedule a meetup and, get a speaker, or if you want to speak to a group about that and get people interested, then very welcome, come and speak to us afterwards. So really, just want to say for Alan Dawson, who's speaking at our next event, just come and say a bit about what he's speaking about.
Great. Hi there, Mark. Thanks for that.
I think the next org event is on Wednesday, 12th of November. There's flyers on the on people's chairs here. Practical privacy tools for everyone. One of the things we're going to be doing is, as Corey was saying here, how privacy tools are quite difficult to people to use. One of the things I want to introduce to you is something called TAILS, which stands for the Amnesiac Incognito Live System, which is a very simple way of protecting internet communications for people, and it solves lots of the it takes all the geekiness and all the complexities out of having private communications on the internet, and it allows you to connect to things like the dark net that was mentioned earlier, and it provides some very, very good privacy tools for people. So that's one of the things that will be happening next. That's next Wednesday. The flyers are there. And additionally, Mark says, I can tell you about an event that's happening in Bradford this week, 15th and 16th of November also, which is the weekend after that. There's a hactionlab.org. It's an organisation in having an event, in Bradford, and they're having a crypto party on Saturday afternoon. Don't have any flyers for that, but if you do your DuckDuckGo or your search engine of choice for Haction Lab Bradford, November the 15th, 16th. And if anybody's based in that area of Sheffield, it'd be great to see that area of Yorkshire, it'd be great to see you there.
Thanks. Last thing I just want to mention is we've got a national conference coming up on the 15th or 16th of November, where ARGA are discussing our policies for what to do about a general election in 2015. So we're looking at which parties are supporting digital rights and how we can get the government to take digital rights on board as a serious issue in the election. So that's ArgCon 15th of November, and that's in King's College London. And if anyone is thinking of going down to there, then I'm going to, so maybe we can travel together or get a group together to go down together. So thank you all for coming. And, Thank you. Big hand again for calling.